From KRCC, Southern Colorado's NPR station, this is Aircheck, a show about great music from the Pikes Peak region and beyond. I'm Jake Brownell, producer at KRCC.
I'm Jeff Beery, program director and host of the Blue Plate Special.
And I'm Vicki Greger, the music director and morning music host at KRCC.
Today's episode of Aircheck, we share some of our favorite new releases from the last month. Vicki chats with legendary blues artist Booker T. Jones. Local musician Rents Liam, aka Dear Rabbit, talks about his latest project, They're Not Like You. And we tell the story of musician Ulysses Baxter, the Pikes Peak peanut pusher. All that today on Aircheck.
As usual, we begin our show with the musical roundtable, where Jeff, Jake, and I talk about a song that's been resonating in our heads over this last month. You know, it's summertime. There's lots to choose from. You're sharing music with the neighbors, blasting out of the speakers behind your house.
It better be good.
Certainly riding around in your car with the windows rolled down and it's cranked up, some of the songs that we can't get out of our heads this month. Jake, I'd like to start with you.
All right. The song that I would like to select is from an artist, a new artist or newer. He's relatively young out of London. His name is Jamie Isaac, and it's a song called Pigeon off an album that is yet to be released. And the album is going to be called Couch Baby. And this guy is kind of part of a scene in London, derived in some ways from people like James Blake, this sort of electronic R&B singer-songwriter, very atmospheric production, and I understand that this guy has a jazz background as far as playing jazz piano, and so you definitely hear that coming through in his production. And well, let's just get into it. This is Jamie Isaac, and the song is called Pigeon.
My body won't know it's hard to sleep, it's pulling me down, choking my neck, it goes deep. So I run so, so tiny. I guess I'm on my own list. And I've been waiting for my break, so no, for someone like you. Someone like you. I'm moving off and now my lunge is weak, is breaking my tongue, lowering.
So it kind of goes on like that.
That is beautiful.
Yeah, it's a nice kind of mellow vibe. I don't know, it just sort of reminds me of rainy nights in London.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of Jose Gonzalez and Roxy Music having a baby together.
Nice.
That's lovely. Wow, you can just fall backwards into that.
So what do you know about him? Is there an album coming out?
So the full album is coming out soon, and this was sort of an early single off of that album.
Nice.
And I've always had a sort of affinity for this kind of singer-songwriter electronic thing, and especially this British production and the kind of experimental electronic sound. I just think it's... I don't know. I could listen to it all day.
Mm-hmm.
That is Jake's best pick yet, I think, Vicki.
Wow, Jeff. That's some high praise coming from you there.
Jamie Isaac, we'll have to keep our eyes peeled for his upcoming release.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Vicki, I think you're next up.
Wow. Well, this wasn't too hard because I always anticipate this woman's music. The record that I've been swirling around, literally, is Beth Orton's Kid Sticks. And it's a bit of a different record. You know, Beth Orton, you know her work with William Orbit and with the Chemical Brothers early on, where they kind of called it folktronic, kind of had that trip-hop beginning to it. And then as she progressed within her records, it got more and more folk-based. And now she's come back around, not exactly back to the folktronic thing, but she does revisit beats and almost like a EDM, electric dance music, touches here and there. A bunch of 80s feeling in this too. The song Moon, it's so beautiful. I love it because it builds with this kind of TikTok percussion with these clangs and these washes and just gorgeous music from Beth Orton.
Well, let's take a listen. This is Beth Orton and the song is called Moon.
I know how the sun feels like on my skin. I want to know what the moon feels like within. I know what the sun feels like on my skin. I want to know how the moon gives life within. And the same moon rises over me as you. There's really not much about that we can do. I see a light and it bright, keeps me up all night. I see a light and it bright, keeps me up all night.
That's cool.
Yeah. It makes me think of The Cure, A Forest, little Susie and the Banshees, mm-hmm. all mixed in together with Beth's very unique voice. And you know, she's just singing about the moon and the sun and all of our coming together
like
as
it.
People, but very simple, but very lush.
Nice vocals. She's always had such wonderful vocal qualities, too.
So this is on Anti, the record label?
Right. And, you know, she's been through a few labels and stuff, and I just like that the music industry continues to support her.
Yeah.
You know, no matter how long it's been between records, because she can take some time off. She's had a few kids, and, you know, she just, when she gets back into the music scene, it's usually a record that, you know, just represents that phase of her life.
And Anti has done some really good projects.
I think Rihanna's most recent album came out on Anti, which it's interesting thinking of Rihanna and Beth Orton on the same label, but it works.
Great, yeah.
That'd be a good cocktail party.
Yeah.
I'm going to see if I can get an invite on that one.
Yeah, right? Jeff, it's your turn.
So I'm picking the new Case Langevers CD. And the reason I'm picking it is because of Laura Veers, local girl, graduated from Palmer High School, and she has hooked up, married a man named Tucker Martin, who is this incredible producer. Has produced this new Case Langevers CD.
And so we should say Nico Case, Katie Lang, Laura Veers.
Exactly. So these three women have gotten together, and they're like three generations of Femicana. I don't know. What would you call
it? You just coined a phrase,
yeah.
Sir.
Three generations, K.D. Lang, the eldest, and then Nico Case, and now the new generation of Laura Veers. They've all come together and made this beautiful album. So I want to pick a song from these three women, a collaboration, a song that Nico Case really takes the lead on. It's called Down I-5.
Driving down I-5, I don't ever want to die, cause I'd no more get to see all this beauty passing by.
So there it is, and you know, there's Tucker Martin's production influence. What a lucky guy. I mean, that's like a producer's dream to be able to hang out with these three men.
Nico Case, one of the vocalists of our time.
Katie Lang, one of the vocalists.
Really. And listen to the way their voices come together on that backing harmony on the chorus. And that is just beautiful. Yeah. It's like wind whistling down, you know, blowing little papers and things.
Yeah. It's definitely, it's just got that beautiful kind of folk production, just so wet with reverb.
There's almost an old English folk pop component to Nico's.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's pretty cool that Colorado Springs' own Laura Beers.
Yeah.
Yeah, who really has continued to make one wonderful record after another.
And you know what else I learned is that Tucker Martin, this guy who's legendary as a producer, used to be a DJ at our sister station KGNU up in Boulder. So
really?
Yeah, so there's this local connection with this album that is that I think we can all really be proud of.
All right, well, that concludes the music review section of the show. Once again,
until next time.
You're listening to Aircheck on KRCC.
On the next segment of Aircheck, Vicky, I gotta say I'm a little jealous that I played hooky on the day that you got to chat with Booker T. Jones, legendary soul, rhythm, and blues artist, Stax recording artist, four-time Grammy Award winner, and the guy that plays Green Onions every day at noon for the Blue Plate Special. What was this guy like? How did that go?
Well, it was very exciting, but I do have to tell you, I couldn't drink enough water as the phone was ringing to connect to him, because all of a sudden my mouth was drier than anything I've ever experienced. And that passed immediately as soon as I talked to him, because Booker T is a very spiritual, quietly intense, thoughtful man, and I knew this was going to be an interesting conversation.
He is an icon in the blues and soul, rhythm, and blues music genre. I mean, this guy has played with everybody. He's not only a musician, right, but he was an executive at the record companies.
Vice president of Stax Records. So I had an opportunity to talk to him about his amazing musical career. We also talked about his upcoming performance at the 10th annual Blues Under the Bridge.
Can't wait. All right, so here's the interview. Vicky with Booker T. Jones.
Booker T. Jones, thank you so much for spending a little time with me today. I can't tell you how very excited I am about this. There's so much I could talk to you about, but what I'm really interested in is just, did you hit the planet knowing that music was going to be the thing that you did, that you were?
No, I didn't have that awareness at a young age. I just had the curiosity. But I did have the opportunity. My mother was a pianist and a singer, and she played all sorts of music in the house when I was a little boy. And my father was a singer, so I had all the opportunity there. And I was born on Edith Street, not too far from South Memphis and Beale Street, so I was able to hear a lot of the original blues and gospel in its original forms, gospel music written by Miss Lucy Campbell, who wrote so many of the spiritual hymns that black churches sing today and their standards today, and also W.C. Handy, who came from Georgia to Memphis, so I was able to latch on to his music at an early age.
Oh, wow. That is just so amazing. And you started to try different instruments, and it seems like you fell in love with a lot of them. Thinking about the Hammond organ and the B3, where did that love affair kick in? We so associate that with Booker T. Jones.
Yes, I like I said, my location was good. Around the corner from my house was a piano teacher who became my piano teacher. And in her dining room, she had a Hammond B3. And I was able to get lessons on that. And then I was, inspired by Ray Charles and his recordings on the Hammond M3 with Quincy Jones that I could hear on the radio and on record. Well, that's when my destiny, I think, was known to me when I heard him play. And I thought, well, that's what I would love to be able to do that with my life. And it just so happened that when I did get into Satellite Records, they also had an M3 organ there.
Oh, there it is. Now, you were a relatively young man when you co-wrote Green Onions. If you don't mind me asking, I know you've been asked about Green Onions millions of times, but where did that come from? Where was the seed of that idea? Or was that just a little riff that got stuck in your head? How was that born?
I was 17 when we recorded it. And when I was 15, I asked the piano teacher, Mr. Pender at Booker T. Washington, if he'd give me theory lessons after school. And that's when I started to learn the progressions of the theory class that led to Green Onions, counting the notes and identifying the chords and their relationships. And I stumbled on a strange chord structure, the 1-3-5, which was kind of different from the ones we were playing in the clubs. And that became the chord structure for Green Onions.
How does that feel to have written this song that it even goes beyond being a standard? It's in the DNA of, like, people, of, the human race.
Well, I don't think I realized that other people related to it until I heard it on the radio. And then that's when I thought, well, that sounds pretty good. And I liked it personally. I still like the song. I still like the recording of it. I still try to recreate it when I'm on stage. Whenever I can.
I think about Potato Hole, one of my favorite records by you, and the work with the Drive-By Truckers, and talk about a marriage made in heaven. I mean, can people just sort of stumble upon Booker T. Jones and say, hey, I want to work with you?
Well, when I was young, the word got out among the music community. There was a fellow named Robert Talley that was working with Rufus Thomas in Memphis, and he heard about me. He heard that I could play baritone sax, and that's how I got invited to Stax. He called David Porter, and David Porter came and got me from algebra class. And so people heard about me, and it went, just like I talk about young musicians that I hear of that are great. The word got out about me all the way to Duke Ellington.
Oh, wow.
So it did. My mom said no, of course. But that happens, and I think that's still happening. So these people attract each other. David Hood was a bass player at Muscle Shoals, and his son was band leader for the Drive-By Truckers.
Right.
So his son had heard all my music when he was a little boy, and so we just kind of naturally got attracted. And those things just kind of happen, people talk, people just get attracted to one another.
I'm very excited to say I'm going to actually get to meet you. You're going to be coming to Colorado Springs on July 30th. You're playing our Blues Under the Bridge Festival, and we couldn't be more delighted. That crowd and that participation and joy, I've never seen anything like it, really, at any other festival I've been to. Blues people are the best.
That's great. It's, it's music that is indigenous to the United States, the South, and all the migrations of the African American people and a number of whites picked it up, Elvis Presley, and jazz people picked it up, Count Basie and so forth. And it just has that that thing that people need, the blues side.
Right, it's the thing that people need. Beautifully put. Booker T. Jones, I want to thank you so much for spending time with me and talking today, and so looking forward to seeing you at Blues Under the Bridge. I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome, Vicky. Thanks for calling. Looking forward to meeting you.
That was Vicky Gregor speaking with legendary blues artist Booker T. Jones, who will be playing this summer at the 10th annual Blues Under the Bridge Festival on July 30th. For more information on that show, you can head to krcc.org. You're listening to AirCheck. Stay with us. CC in Colorado Springs, this is AirCheck, a show about great music from the Pikes Peak region and beyond. I'm Jake Brownell, producer at KRCC.
I'm Jeff Beery, host of the Blue Plate Special, program director.
I'm Vicky Gregor, music director and morning music host. In this next segment of AirCheck, we're going to delve deeply into the mind of GT, host of Vintage Voltage, who knows too much about everything from the past.
Yeah.
Enthusiastic Mr. Entertainment. And I've got to tell you, you know how you think of Johnny Cash as the man in black?
Mm-hmm.
GT's the man in white.
GT, yeah, it was time for us to talk with GT. We gave GT an assignment just like we gave Dick Fairley earlier, who talked about jazz. Wanted GT to come up with some patriotic songs from the past, because it's the 4th of July weekend, and we thought, GT's the man. So he came in with two variations on two songs about America. And it's interesting to hear him talk about these variations and what excites him. You get that when you hear him on his show, that he's a pretty excitable guy. But to really find out why that is, I think we may have to revisit GT again and try and dig a little deeper.
All right, let's take a listen to that interview. Jeff and our very own GT.
So it's the 4th of July, we're going to get patriotic. And today, GT, because you are who you are, You're kind of a pop geek. We're going to pick, now I understand you're going to pick two songs that have two variations each, correct?
You got it. Yeah, that's correct. One of the songs that I'm going to be playing is Simon and Garfunkel's version of America. That's
Frenemies, kind of like you and me, right?
We're sort of KRCC's version of Simon and Garfunkel without the musicality.
Right.
We have our own musicality going here. It's a verbal kind of musicality.
So they are
music.
They are singing a song called America.
Right.
And then we're going to hear this same song again by someone else.
Yes. This song was recorded, or I should say this song was written originally by Paul Simon. He came up with the idea of it in 1964. Simon and Garfunkel had recorded their debut album in 1964 called Wednesday Morning 3 a.m. Then Paul Simon, the album, you know, was, they didn't know how it was going to do. Paul Simon goes back over to England in the meantime, where he's been playing folk clubs, and he's hanging with his girlfriend. Paul Simon got the idea for writing the song America when he and his girlfriend came back over to America from England to go ahead and touch base with producer Tom Wilson about the recording and the release of Wednesday Morning 3 a.m. So they drove around for 5 days on a road trip in 1964, when all the while he was supposed to be attending, you know, to the post-production of Wednesday Morning, 3 a.m. So he's getting this idea for the song America, and then he completed the writing of it in 66.
So let's hear this song, and then we're going to hear the follow-up, different take on the song.
Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said be careful, his bow tie is really a camera.
So this is classic Simon and Garfunkel. Every American has heard this, and this is America.
Yeah, well, the amazing thing about it, of course, is that not only have a lot of Americans heard it, but, you know, with their worldwide popularity, a lot of other folks around the world have heard
this
song, America.
That's why we are.
That is particularly representative of Paul Simon's perception at the time of America. He's searching for America. He can't find it.
All right, so the second song, the remake of this is by
the group Yes, the
Yes.
English prog rock group Yes.
So we switch from this Americana folk duo Simon and Garfunkel to a prog rock group. An English prog rock group.
Yeah, yeah.
And singing about America.
One of the things that distinguished Yes is they had so many different influences coming at them that they would incorporate into the recording and the compositions of their music. They would use classical stuff in there. They were influenced by the pop harmony group, the Fifth Dimension, early on. They would do Beatles covers. They'd do covers by the Byrds. So they were influenced by American West Coast pop. They would incorporate classical motifs into this. So it's kind of interesting to listen to Yes's version and see what they do with this, as you were saying, kind of a pop folk or a folk rock, as they were calling it, version at the time. Let's see what Yes does with the Paul Simon composition, America.
I'm not hearing it. Where's America? Where's America in this?
It's coming. They have to get all their other influences, the things they wanted to incorporate in there out of the way in the meantime. Also, what's interesting about this is at one point, Chris Squire, the bass player, starts playing a little bit of a lick from Leonard Bernstein's song, America, which we're going to listen to a little bit later.
Oh, this is just a bad British bastardization of America.
See, da-da-da, search for America. We all came to search for America.
Are there any vocals in this song?
It's coming, yeah. You have to get the other guys to get their rocks off, though, first. Everybody will show off their chops.
Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together.
They lost me 3 minutes ago. Eject. Eject. All right. So, GT, what... Do you like this music?
I see you playing
drums over there. I see you, you know...
Yeah, every minute.
You got
minute
your guitar face
now, granted,
on.
You know, a prog rock is a little bit of an acquired taste. It's very much a niche genre right now. But back in, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, really, you know, in Prague's Purple Patch, if you will, yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of these albums were topping the charts. These bands were hugely popular. But, yeah, prog rock probably peaked in popularity, you know, early 70s, definitely, you know, with a number of these groups, including the group that we're going to play also eventually called The Nice. There was a group called The Nice, formed in 1967, featured the late, great Keith Emerson. And Keith Emerson, of course, went to join the trio Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. They were formed in 1970, yeah. And again, this was a group that was running neck and neck in popularity with Yes. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, and Yes, you know, you can
Brits
see them.
Brits as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And what they're going to do is they do a version, what we're going to hear pretty soon here, is a version of the Leonard Bernstein, Stephen Sondheim composition, America, is originally featured in West Side Story. and they're going to do their version of it, and they're kind of give it the Yes treatment, except they're going to give it the, obviously, the okay. Nice treatment.
Well, let's have a listen to the Broadway show tune, America.
I like the island Manhattan.
I know you don't
smoke on your pipe and put that in.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a small fee in America.
You know, Anita is the girlfriend of Bernardo, who's the head of the Sharks, the Puerto Rican-American gang. Anita, you know, is very pro-American, but her girlfriends are very con-American, if you will. So they're debating the merits and the demerits of being in America and having come to America accordingly.
12 in a room in America.
Lots of new housing with more space.
Lots of doors slamming in our face.
I'll get a terrace apartment.
Better get rid of your accent.
Life can be bright. All right, so that's the Leonard Bernstein version of America from West Side Story. Kind of a double-edged sword in that song about our beloved U.S. of A. Now let's check out a version of the same song by the British prog group The Nice.
This was The Nice's second single, released in 1968.
And how did it do in America?
It did a whole heck of a lot over here. Kind of like when Yes started out, they were very much a cult band. And it was the way they recorded it was very controversial as well, the way they presented it, because Keith Emerson at one point ended up burning the American flag. It was intended ironically. And especially in 1968, look at all the civil unrest you have going on in 1968. So when they recorded this, it was intended just as much a tribute to the song as it was...
Huh. Interesting.
You know, presented with their own particular perspective, which was kind of an anti-American perspective in a way.
Yeah.
Again, you know, you had Keith Emerson burning the flag at one particular concert. There's that incurred a lot of controversy, naturally enough.
So there we go. There's The Nice, their version of America. GT, let me ask you this. What is your interest in this? You're spanning a lot of different genres here. You are putting a song under a microscope. Where are you getting this information? How long have you been reading fanzines to find out these amazing details? Where are you getting this?
Since Moses was a boy, Jeff, it's been a long time since then. But, you know, one of the things I find that's really sort of interesting and informative, if you will, about comparing these songs, it's a good way to be able to define these genres. Let's go ahead and we'll play some standard pop in the way of West Side Story.
Mm-hmm.
We'll play the Broadway version. How best to describe to somebody what progressive pop is all about, what prog rock is all about. Let's play you a prog rock version of that very same song you heard in a more standardized pop version originally, and that way then you can compare the two. You have some kind of a basis instead of just playing somebody out a prog rock song flat out.
Do you subscribe to some sort of weird pulp pop magazine? Is there something that you're still kind of ingesting about the 60s, 70s, are you still reading this? Are you still
studying? Yeah, I kind of keep up on it. These days, you know, in the digital age, if you will, you know, and in this age of mass media information, it's not, you don't necessarily have to result to any kind of a cultish fanzine anymore. You know what I mean? It's kind of all there. Now, back in the day we did, especially if you had particular interests, like anybody who's interested in one particular thing, especially if it has a cult following, you know, you're going to tend to steer yourselves towards those specialty type magazines. But these days, you don't even necessarily have to go out and look for that kind of thing. And it's always kind of a trade-off, you know, because back in the day, of course, there was a fun sensibility about it, if you will, in that you were able to seek out stuff, you know, and find something that nobody else had. And these days, you know, you can just go ahead and pull it up like that.
You just sit down at your computer.
Right.
And...
But it's nice and convenient as well. You don't have to scrounge around for a whole bunch of different things.
We end it with that. GT, thanks for
thank you so much for having
your
me.
Psyche with us here on AirCheck.
That was Jeff Beery talking to GT, host of Vintage Voltage. You can catch him Saturday evenings here on KRCC. You're listening to Air Check.
So for our next segment, we wanted to invite a longtime friend of the station, a local musician who has been a central figure in the local music scene here. That's Rents Liam, a.k.a. Dear Rabbit. And he just released a new album called They're Not Like You, or it's actually just about to come out. And he's got a CD release show coming up for that this month. And so, Vicky, what do you think of this new album?
I am a big fan of this new record. I've had it here at the station for a few weeks, listening to everything on it. It's a very varied record. You know, this record was a real collaborative process, too, working with friends and musicians, including Alex Koshak and Adam Hawkins. And you can really hear and appreciate that collaboration. It's a feast for the ears.
All right, well, let's take a listen to that. This is Vicky Gregor speaking with Rents Liam, also known as Dear Rabbit.
The man you miss was your dad. He was your dad. He worked so hard for us in our lands, all our lands.
Rents, thank you so much for hanging out today.
Well, thank you for having me come in.
Oh, yeah, it's a pleasure. And what I want to talk to you about is I want to get right to it. I want to talk about this new record that you've made, They're Not Like You, and just talk a little bit about some of the sounds and some of the songs that are on this record, which, by the way, is incredibly good.
Thank you. I'm super pumped on it, and I don't know where to start because it's kind of half and half, but there are a lot of songs that I wrote just while I was living on the road, and I would just have ideas, and I'd just sing them into my cell phone, and then when I get back home, I'd have to figure it out on guitar or whatever and all that, and then I bring it to the studio and say, all right, I don't even know what you guys want to do with these songs. Here are these songs I wrote, and then it came out. I didn't even know what to expect, but I love how it came out.
Yeah. So when you brought this back to the studio, so this was pretty collaborative. You worked closely with some other people then to develop the songs.
Oh, I mean, I wrote the songs all the way through, and then just like, all right, you know, I first kind of showed some of the songs to Alex, and then every now and then Adam would come in on a part, and he'd play a guitar or a bass line, and so yeah, it was collaborative as far as everybody just coming in and bringing in something to
a
the
very
table.
Natural,
then,
a very
yeah, natural, yeah,
and it's organic in a way. You know, I think about some of your other records and. Using the word organic, that's what was in my head when I was thinking about this. The way the instrumentation came together, there was something very organic, and there is an energy to this record that really, really, I was dancing in the office.
Oh,
let me just say
you.
That. And I'll tell you the one, Naturally You. That was the mm-hmm. song I went to immediately.
I left in walls. They got up in four things like that. Spray cans and plastic rings, but you...
And what I love about that song is, you know, I'm a New Yorker, and it made me think of like all those really cool modern lover, Ramon, Lou Reed, Patti Smith, kind of like that New York energy that was from the 70s. I really felt that listening to specifically Naturally You and really partial to I Wrecked a Bus.
Nice.
Is that just something influenced by? I know you listen to a lot of different kinds of music yourself. I mean, is it just like a sponge effect, you know, where you mix you with stuff that you loved and here comes the new baby?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was very naturally.
Naturally You.
It started out a little different, you know, with. On the song Naturally, I was playing guitar and we completely deleted the guitar track, and Alex jumped on the piano and did something, and Then you started playing the bass and like, all right, let's do that. And then let's rock that.
Yeah, the joy comes out. I mean, yeah. Your voice is joyful on song. What about you? What are you partial to? I know it's hard to ask, you know, what's your favorite
child? What's my favorite?
Yeah, but when you're listening to this over and over again, do certain songs jump out at you where you're like, oh yeah, I remember writing that.
Yeah, it's weird. I've been listening to this record a lot. It's incredible how much I can listen to this record. And it's one of me excited. I'm not able to listen to it without getting tired of it. But yeah, Like a Child is one that definitely sticks out.
I get so lonely here sometimes. Friends are great, but I'm so strange inside.
You know, we've been having band rehearsal for the upcoming release show, and that's the one song where it's like, all right, let's put that song in. Like, and I like the Don't Let South Dakota Spiders Eat You a lot.
Oh. The way that's a Dear Rabbit title if there ever was one.
Chicago to New York so far. Tuck those dreams into my car. With you, my trumpet and guitar.
You know, you've been spending a lot of time on the road. I wanted to ask you about that, too. I mean, you're busy and bopping all over the place. What's that experience like? You're on the move, like, all the time now, right?
Yeah, except for this year. But I'm loving the road life. And going back to the record, it contributes a lot to writing this record. About half of it, you know. There's half that I write at home and half I write on the road. And then just figure it out and put it together and... Some of our notes, like I wrecked a bus, or various notes I wrote while sleeping on somebody's couch.
Thinking about too many things at once. Not enough time for a new song.
But really, you know, having that moment influencing you as you're writing, and really what it's like to travel all the time, can you come back into whatever you define as your regular life? Do you have a hard time making that adjustment, or do you like the frenzy of all that?
I like it. It's weird how I come back, and you would think I'll be exhausted, but I'll come back, and I'll get back in town from tour around 11 o'clock midnight, and I'm just pumped, so I go to the bar so I can run into my friends and stuff.
Okay, how do you stay awake on the road, can you say? Lots of coffee. You're drinking radio coffee now. Now this is going to propel you. So,
yeah.
So there's one thing. Back to the traveling piece, the way that you even have to set up your own tours and stuff, right? Setting up your city,
yeah.
Setting up distances, making sure that when you finally roll into town, you're not zapped and want to just go lay down instead of doing one of your... you know, really amazing shows. Did that just come with practice of being on the road a lot?
What are the key ingredients? Of coffee, oregano oil, and garlic are my new things lately. I roll into town, go to the coffee shop, work on booking more and more shows on my laptop, and then go to the next show, and then everybody wants to keep me up until 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I have to drive 6 hours next day to another town. And then I don't even know how to have time to book more tours.
Yeah, you are, your energy is boundless, and I'm so glad for it because I love the idea of this coast-to-coast, this nation, loving Dear Rabbit and knowing who you are, even though we get to claim you as ours.
Oh, I love this home, and that's part of the excitement is bringing these friends of mine that tour and bringing them back here to play shows, and that's been happening a lot, and that's been... part of what bringing this community, and then they come back and say that Colorado Springs is one of their favorite towns too.
Oh, nice to hear that. Yeah, very good to hear that. Well, Rents, Dear Rabbit, thank you so much for your music all these years and all the joy that we've received from that. And I really appreciate you hanging out this afternoon with me.
Thank you for having me here. It's great
to
be here.
A pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Such a jam when you love me. We'll find a way to make it. We'll find a way to
That was Vicky Gregor speaking with Rents Liam of the band Dear Rabbit. His new album, They're Not Like You, is coming out very soon. And you can pick up a copy of that album at his CD release show, which is coming up on Wednesday, July 20th. You're listening to Air Check from KRCC. Stay with us.
Gonna queue up my next cassette tape. Gonna set out for another landscape. I don't know where it's not here. I don't know where it's not here.
La 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 la.
KRCC in Colorado Springs, this is Air Check, a show about great music in the Pikes Peak region and beyond. I'm Jake Brownell, producer at KRCC.
I'm Vicki Greger, music director and host of the Morning Music Mix.
And I'm Jeff Berry, program director here at KRCC. And for this last segment on Air Check today, got a little something different, a piece of Colorado music history. It's the tale of Ulysses Baxter, who was a 21-year-old musician from Oklahoma City who captivated the world back in 1963 with an incredible and unusual feat of endurance right here on Pikes Peak. Jake, the story comes from you. Take it away.
All right. Well, the story begins, as so many great stories do, with a peanut.
This is Ulysses' actual peanut. Pristine condition. You can see all the nice ridges and bumps and rolls on it. Not in too bad a damage, in a nice khaki color, I guess. A normal 50-year-old peanut, if you want to call it that.
This is David Walker, a volunteer at the Manitou Springs Heritage Center. The peanut he's describing, which currently sits on a black pedestal in a glass case in the little volunteer-run museum, was, at one point, probably the most famous peanut in the country.
Yeah, it was quite spread around back then. I mean, that was the interesting part. It was in Philadelphia, Florida, I believe the Tampa Tribune picked it up. A bunch of places like that. It was kind of interesting.
It was the summer of 1963, and people around the country had their eyes trained on Colorado Springs, where a young musician named Ulysses Baxter was doing something remarkable. On hands and knees, over the course of 8 days, he pushed this very peanut all the way up Pike's Peak with his nose.
It was an amazing deal. I mean, if you could think of it, I mean, what does it take to push a peanut across this floor? You know, think of up 14,000 feet. It'd be kind of crazy.
It was kind of crazy. Over the 8 days that Baxter spent inching his way up the mountain, he was exposed to the elements, battered by the trail, and pushed to the brink of exhaustion. But the 21-year-old came out the other side with national notoriety and an incredible story to tell.
It was a success, but it was a very rough, rough go. I would never try it again.
This is Ulysses Baxter. He's 74 years old today, living in his hometown of Oklahoma City. But in 1963, Baxter was traveling the country with a rock and roll group called Carlos and the Rockets.
Well, we did quite a variety of everything. I mean, Carlos, of course, did rock and roll, and but we had the dancers and... We even had a monkey in the act. We had Native American dancers in the middle of the show. I was a featured vocalist and very, very fortunate to get that gig, I think, as we called it.
The group was headed to Las Vegas, but stopped to play some shows in Colorado Springs along the way. As Baxter remembers it, while they were in Colorado Springs, the group's manager heard about a man named Bill Williams, a Texan who in 1929 pushed a peanut up the Pikes Peak Highway with his nose for a $500 bet. The manager saw an opportunity.
So he decided that I should do it for whatever reason. Muscular dystrophy, we were going to do it for muscular dystrophy. And Ox set off on Jerry Lewis's telephone. And so they convinced me to do it, reluctantly.
As Baxter and his team made preparations for the push, they learned that Jerry Lewis had backed out. They searched for other charity angles, but after another fell through, it became clear that Baxter's feat would be his own. It took a bit more convincing, but he ultimately agreed.
So I agreed to do it, and front page news the next day. Singer to cost peak with proboscis, I think, was a headline.
With the media alerted, fans excited, and a rescue team ready to assist, Baxter began his ascent.
I started on the 9th of July, I did a show at the entrance of Bar Trail with me and the Tuxedo and Dancing Girls and Carlos and the Rockets and the mayor and the press. And when I started in front of CBS cameras and everything, the mayor gave me the peanut, and we had a coffee spoon attached to my nose. And it broke right away. And I'm on national television, and I'm on cameras and press, and so I pushed the peanut until all the press and the people kind of started scattering with my nose. And it was all cut up, and it was televised. So there's a lady who brought out a salad spoon type thing with a headband, and that's what I used for the rest of the trip.
Baxter made his way up the mountain with the salad spoon attached to his nose and the peanut wrapped in tape to protect it from the elements. Each day, he'd make a little bit of progress up the rocky, 13-mile-long Bar Trail. He moved slowly, on all fours, and he was followed the whole way by enthusiastic supporters.
It got an amazing amount of attention and respect, and along the trail, the tourists coming off and applauding for me and talking to me. And I remember one morning I was asleep on the trail, and this lady's shaking me, waking me up, putting my autograph early in the morning.
But the trip wasn't without its challenges. On the very first night, Baxter got caught on the mountain in a bad storm and received no help from his manager, who was overseeing the ascent.
The next day, the manager came up and he said, "Son, the radio TV stations and the people called and said, you got to get that boy off the mountain. I mean, we're going to have a terrible storm." He said, "Son," I told him, "we went up and talked to him, and he won't come down until that peanut's to the top." Of course, I knew nothing about it. He was probably sitting back watching television, comfortable, and we're up in the middle of that storm.
And then there was the pain.
It was, I think in the one interview I saw that I did, I said it was hell. That I'd called in every imaginable way. No matter with the padding on your knees and elbows, all the skin, I was down to the cartilage and bone. But you got to remember, I just turned 21 in June, and then we started less than a month after turning 21. So it's pretty young. And motivation is greater than skill or intellect. And I was motivated and determined, I'm going to do this.
His efforts paid off. By the time he reached the top of Pike's Peak, Baxter had become a national sensation. The story had been carried on radio, TV, and in newspapers around the country. People couldn't get enough of the rock and roll musician and his peanut-pushing adventure. On the morning of July 17th, 8 days after he began, Baxter crossed the finish line at the summit of Pike's Peak. He estimates that there were hundreds of people waiting for him, including his bandmates, who brought their instruments to play him through the home stretch.
I crawl up the trail as it hits the flat part of the summit, and the band's already playing. I started singing and did a few numbers and signed a lot of autographs and the press, and that was the conclusion of my push. I was very relieved and quite proud that I accomplished it, and kind of ready to leave the show. I mean, I was kind of angry at my manager for setting all that up, and kind of determined to show him also.
Soon after his feat, Baxter left Carlos and the Rockets. He returned home to Oklahoma to recover from the ordeal, and then formed a new band and started recording and touring under his own name.
Mother, congratulate your son.
He released songs like Mother, Congratulate Your Son and Beautiful Woman.
My mother said, "Son, well, there'll be days you love a woman, but you'll hate her ways. Oh, beautiful woman, a beautiful woman, a beautiful woman with ugly ways."
Before long, he was getting calls to play on national TV shows. He performed on CBS's I've Got a Secret show, and even made an appearance on the Steve Allen show.
He was like Jimmy Kimmel today. He had the Late Show in the 60s. And he challenged me to a peanut push down Hollywood. And pushing peanuts with Steve Allen and Cliff Arquette.
Baxter was living his dream. His music career was taking off. He appeared on TV shows and got acting and modeling gigs. The peanut-pushing feat had launched him onto the national stage. But for all the exposure it got him, it also came with baggage.
I had a lot of musicians and famous big bands that were very critical of the fact that I did that, and they were very angry to my face and told me what a jerk I was, that you had to pay your dues in show business. We worked 20 years before we got in a big band or before we got a break, and here you crawl up a mountain pushing a peanut, and you're a disgrace to show business. So I thought kind of asking people to acknowledge that I did that, because I wanted to succeed in different areas and be recognized for my talent, not the fact that I call it Pike's Peak.
Lavender, lavender lace is hiding her face and teardrops that fall.
This is Lavender Lace, another of Baxter's songs from the mid-60s. Baxter continued his career in music and show business through the early 70s. But despite his successes, at the age of 30, he decided to give it up.
Well, I had a very religious family, and I had brothers, a brother that contended that I was killing my mother singing in Las Vegas, and I don't know. They said I was entertaining for the devil, and this was against our religious beliefs. And it's also interfering in marriage and relations, traveling. And so I decided to just do other things.
He admits the decision was a bittersweet one.
Well, of course you miss that. You know, there's nothing like the rush of walking out on the stage with people applauding and liking your show and enjoying your music and, you know, banging on tables and standing on and applauding and... there's nothing quite like that high after you've had a successful show. So I've often regretted that I didn't continue, because I really think I would have achieved the peak that I wanted to reach. I had wished to reach the peak of success of Elvis Presley and Frank Sinatra.
Nevertheless, Baxter says he went on to have a successful career. He opened a chain of hair salons, developed a cosmetics line, and invested in real estate. Today, he lives in Oklahoma City, where he's active in humanitarian causes and is raising money to open an orphanage. And all these years later, after all the music, the TV appearances, his business career, he says he's learned to embrace his identity as the Pike's Peak peanut pusher. There was a time, he says, when he wanted to escape it, but no longer.
And now... being 74 years of age, and with it being just recognized and talked about through the years, I feel kind of good about the fact that I did it. And I feel good that it seems to be an inspiration. I understand school teachers have used me as an illustration, and you know, I guess your museum there, they said they adapted to one of my sayings of no problem is larger than a peanut and can be conquered with courage and persistence, and some other slogans. So it makes me feel good that people are still impressed and like to hear the story. So that makes you feel good.
You can hear more of Baxter's music and see a picture of him from 1963 pushing a peanut up Pike's Peak at krcc.org. Check is a production of KRCC in Colorado Springs. For more information on any of the artists or stories that you heard in this show, you can head to krcc.org. Many thanks to our interns, Mira Fisher and Margot Lederer. For KRCC and AirCheck, I'm Jake Brownell.
I'm Jeff Beery.
I'm Vicki Greger.